international finance law. We want to understand the nature of application of many of the key provisions and key principles that we're looking at in relation to specific operational type examples which may come up in a law firm or banking situation. What we're looking at is the different types of facilities that we can use and that we can have, and how we can structure different types of deals to make the most use of all of the various types of available facilities in practice. I have given you a list of possible examples. If, for example, a client wants to raise £500 million to construct a new hotel tower, again by way of example, in Pudong in Shanghai, how would it do that? It can go banking markets, it can go capital markets, it can go a long 20-year syndicated loan, for example, 20 years, 5%. Or it can go for capital markets, a long bond, again, because it's a bond that's fixed rate, so 5%. If it's a note, that's floating rate. We could raise the same 500 million through a syndicated lending, so it's a group of banks providing funds to the principal borrower and other companies within the borrower's group. So, for example, we may have 10 banks in the syndicate, we may have one borrower, 9 subsidiaries, that's 10 borrowers. If it's a $500 million facility, if it's 20 years at 5%, governed on standard international terms, almost all of which are based on the Loan Market Association in London's standard multi-currency and term loan facility, let me just ask, how many loans will there be? If we have 10 banks and 10 borrowers, under the standard facility, there will be an A and a B, an A and a B option. The A is the term loan for the full 20 years. You draw down, you repay, you do not draw down again. Facility B is a revolver. It's usually smaller, so you draw down, repay back, draw down, repay back. In the example that we've given, if we have, for example, 10 banks, 10 borrowers, we've got facility A, there will be an availability period. For example, 2 years. We can draw down every month for 2 years. So the total number of loans is 10 times 10 times 2 times 12. That's 2,400. Under the facility B, we can draw down for possibly up to the whole duration of the outstanding arrangement. So that could be 20 years. So in that case, it's 10 borrowers, 10 banks, so 10 times 10, times each month 12, over 20 years times 12, that's 24,000 this time, isn't it? So if we add the A's and B's together, 2,400 and 24,000 is 26,400 loans altogether. In terms of the key provisions within the loan agreement itself, we know from the core facilities clause, section 2.2, all of the obligations are several. The rights are separate and independent, and we can have separate enforcement. There is separate enforcement, although there's also the sharing clause, pari passu, 28. But what this effectively means is each of these loans is separate facility in law. There is, however, a possible provision on the total number of loans being limited, and we have a consolidation clause and a division clause. If you remember where that is, it's in section 10.4. There will be a possible limit, so even though there could legally be up to 26,400 loans, separate loans under this single facility, this single loan agreement, there could be a limit in the clause which will specify maybe only 5,000 or 10,000. We can also then consolidate or divide. If we've got too many outstanding and we want to create more, what do? We consolidate. So if there's a 5,000 limit and we're going to breach it, what we can do is consolidate other loans so we can create more loans on top of that. We need to think about how all the different facilities which are created, all the different clauses, could operate together in practice. With regards to other options on the exercise that I've given you, instead of going loan or long bond, the long bond could be another 20 years, fixed 5%, 500 bonds, $1 million. Dollars each. Instead of that, we could have shorter duration instruments. So we can go down to medium term notes, let's say 10-year notes. In that case, we draw down the notes, we repay after 10 and then draw down again. So an example I've given, we could have 10-year notes, so 10,000 notes, 500,000 each. We could then go shorter to euro notes. This time we're going to repay after 4 years, draw down again, repay after another 5 years. So four times is 4 into 20, so 5 years. Every 5 years, we roll over. We repay, we draw down, we repay, we draw down, we repay. Again, the amounts would go down because each time with shorter duration, we have a smaller amount, we just have more of them, more of the notes, and we roll them over faster. That's all we're doing. What we can also do is we can have a MOF, a multi-option facility, whereby we could have a medium-term note with a commercial paper program, with a banker's acceptance program, with a short-term advance program, and with a swing line facility to allow us to move between the different arrangements outstanding. All of this is covered in detail in the chapter. What the paper also refers to is possibly using project finance so that all of this operates on a non-recourse basis. The facility A could be used to purchase the land and the main construction works. The facility B would be for working capital and fitting out. Project finance is non-recourse. What that means is this: we're going to build something, the future income stream that's projected to be created is calculated to ensure that economically the project's viable. So over the 20 years of this project, the income stream that's generated will produce sufficient funds to pay all of the costs involved. We've effectively built something for free. That's how project finance works. Much of the major infrastructure in the world is based on project finance for this simple reason. I've also given a further example of securitization, whereby we have a number of mortgage pools. Because of that income pool, we can securitize those, we pull the assets together, we transfer them to a special purpose vehicle. The special purpose vehicle is going to issue new notes into the market to buy the pool. So we've effectively moved non-transferable loan-based mortgages and converted them into transferable negotiable notes. And then if there's any other risks of any form, for example, foreign currency risk or interest rate risk, we can use swaps for those. So we can see with this simple worked example all the different types of facilities that we could use in practice in relation to the different types of needs that clients may have for their application of funds. What I've then done is provide a separate set of exercises which consider how the specific LMA clauses will apply, as well as the other rights and remedies under the bond or note documentation and the liability principles that we also have to consider overriding all of this. So let's just work through these two examples. We've got, in the first case, a large, this is loan-based, and then the second example is bond-based. So we have a large Greek shipping company specialising in crude oil transportation. This is very similar to the Springwell decision with the Polemis Greek shipping family. And what we saw in that case was to do with Russian GKO notes. That was government Russian bond-linked notes. We thought there'd be no default, but there was a Russian default in 1998, which lost investors a very substantial amount of money. This then overlaps with the Springwell decision and the PK decision, P-E-E-K-A-Y, which is also in the separate notes I gave you in the materials on case law. So you've got PK, you've got the IFC versus Goldman Sachs decision, you've got the DPAC decision, and you've got the Abu Dhabi versus Morgan Stanley clause. All those clauses are examined in all of these decisions. Generally, the court supports the effectiveness of all of the exclusion clauses that we are going to draft and prepare. All of the means for limiting liability, the heads of liability, and the controls, the techniques we can use to limit all of that is provided for in the separate chapter on liability that I have also provided on the system. What we're doing is seeing how those various sets of provisions and principles and case law decisions apply in practice in these two exercises. So, we have this large Greek shipping company specialising in crude oil transportation. It wishes to purchase a number of new vessels. It wants to raise £60 million over 10 years. with 50 million to purchase the fleet, 10 million for working capital. It's already raised funds in the domestic markets in Greece, but it wants to go to the London Eurodollar markets. It approaches Morgan Bank, which is a subsidiary of a major investment house, let's assume Morgan Stanley. Morgan Stanley recommends this should be loan market rather than bond market in light of the specialised nature of the lending and possible lack of investor interest, especially following recent losses in the shipping industry. We then refer to the various documents which are involved. We have the mandate letter, the term sheet, the information memorandum, and then the formal loan agreement. Due to a clerical error, the standard limitation clauses are omitted, so we have to still consider what how they would have operated if they'd applied, and then the effect of this legally, because they're excluded. There's three sets of standard control provisions. There's five no-duty clauses, so we limit the scope of duty so there can be no liability if there's no responsibility to do something. And those specifically apply in relation to no confirmation of accuracy, no on-credit assessment, no inducement clause, no fiduciary duty clause. We then have general exclusion clauses, although these are extended to apply to innocent, negligent and fraudulent misrepresentation, criminal liability and statutory duty. What we're going to see is this. Exclusion clauses are perfectly legitimate, perfectly reasonable, perfectly viable, although there's certain things we cannot exclude, and those include fraud or fraudulent misrepresentation, criminal liability, statutory liability, where the clause is misrepresented, and where there's a separate oral warranty. This is all provided for in the separate paper made available. In this case, there's difficulties, markets downturn, there's default, and the question is, who can the syndicate members sue? Can they go against each other? Can they go against the lead bank? Can they go against the agent bank? What's also happened as well, the lead bank in this case has transferred its lending commitments to Singapore Bank. It's not transferred the benefit, it's transferred the obligation, so therefore it's not going to have been an legal or equitable assignment in law, it's going to have to have been a novation. Legal and equitable assignment under are determined as to whether they've satisfied the conditions under the Section 136 of the Law of Property Act, 1925. Was the assignment in writing? Was it for an unconditional amount? And was notice given to the borrower? That's legal assignment. If any of those isn't complied with, including specifically notice or the amount being not unconditional, then it's an equitable assignment. In this case, it would have to have been a novation because we've transferred the obligations to the lender. What then happens is we raise a series of questions and we can look at these very briefly. Explain the nature of the liability of each of the syndicate members to each other, basically. Syndication, we look at the core principles of syndication. We can consider this in terms of the nature of the separate loans involved. That's set out in the LMA. We already mentioned that was specifically clause 2 stop 2. The obligations are several, the rights are separate and independent, and we have separate enforcement, 2-2 under the LMA. We also have the general principle of syndication, and I've referred to this in my chapter as well as on the summary paper table that you've got, and that's on the paper here. Severality, proportionality, equality, democracy, limited delegation of function, and then the limited delegation of function corresponds with the duties of the agent bank. Receipt, payment, banking, notification, and default. In terms of transfer, we've already mentioned, because the lending commitment has been moved to Singapore Bank, this must have been a novation, so you can then explain the difference between novation and legal and equitable assignment. We also have participations, sub-participations. We can also create effective parallel economic and legal interests through, for example, securitization and trusts. All of that is dealt with in the papers provided. We're then looking at the heads of liability. This is all set out in the liability paper. There's five key sets of possible liability. Common law misrepresentation, that's innocent, negligent, or fraudulent. Statutory misrepresentation and deceit. Statutory misrepresentation is Section 2.1 and Section 2.2 of the Misrepresentation Act 1967. and then we could have possible agency liability, fiduciary liability, and regulatory liability. In practice, what we're principally looking at is common law innocent misrepresentation and common law negligent misrepresentation, as well as statutory misrepresentation under Section 2(1) of the Misrepresentation Act. The key point of it, Section 2(1), is that previously we had to establish fraudulent intent. Now we only have to establish that a misrepresentation was made. Loss was suffered. What Section 2(1) then does is transfer the onus of proof to the other party. The other party then needs to establish that they made the statement with reasonable belief that it was true and it was in fact true. They have to establish this statutory duty of defence, which is that they had reasonable ground to believe and did in fact believe up until the time the contract was entered into that the facts represented were true. It effectively transfers the obligation, transfers the burden of proof. This is what we have to watch in practice. Those are the core heads of liability. In terms of limiting liability, we can do that through a series of limited duty clauses, limitation clauses, but then we need to watch the exclusion of liability clauses, the controls on that, and then we've also got, you'll see here, an indemnity provision as well. In terms of no duty or basis clauses, we can have no duty, information supply, own credit assessment, no reliance, no fiduciary duty. Standard clauses. In terms of exclusion clauses themselves, these are perfectly reasonable in practice. We just have to watch the statutory controls, which principally apply by importing the reasonableness test from the Unfair Contract Terms Act 1977. The 1977 Act has been amended. In consumer credit situations, we now have the Consumer Rights Act 2015. Unfair contract terms are now dealt with under Part 2 of the Consumer Rights Act 2015. That's Sections 61 to 76, specifically Section 62. But this is not a consumer credit situation. We're dealing with international finance. We're dealing with professional parties. We're contracting with banks and other professional institutions, usually supported with legal advice, with most of these parties either being expert professionals or expert investors in these areas. So the consumer provisions don't apply. We then revert to the Unfair Contract Terms Act 1977, the unreasonableness test, which is imported into negligence situations under the Misrepresentation Act 1967, Section 3. There are three specific provisions in the Unfair Contract Terms Act 1977. You should watch, you should monitor. Section 1 specifies that it applies to negligence, so Section 1(1). We can have no avoidance, that's Section 2(1). The reasonableness test itself is provided for under Section 3(1). The definition of reasonableness, unreasonableness, and reasonableness is in Section 11. And then there's additional guidelines in Schedule 2. So Sections 1(1), 2(1), 3(1), 11 and Schedule 2, all of this is in the papers provided in the materials and in the chapter that you have. If those clauses had provided, had been properly imported, they would have had full legal effect. In this case, however, they were omitted, therefore we cannot use them. There is also a reference to an indemnity clause. Even if the exclusion clauses were unreasonable, it's still arguable that you could have exercised the indemnity clause. So even if the bank has to pay someone suffering loss, they could still get an indemnity from the borrower, but in this case the borrower is already insolvent anyway or unable to pay. So we've got the liability, heads of liability, failure to include, as well as the legal effect if each of these provisions had operated properly, had the intended effects, the basis clauses, the exclusion clauses, and the indemnity provision. The question also then asks, what about the liability of the agent bank? So then again, we can go back to the LMA. This is principally dealt with under Section 26, and we have the core provisions on the scope of the agent bank duty. That's in section 26.1, section 26.2, and then we have the general indemnity clause, where there has to be gross negligence. That's in 26.9. So the agent bank liability provisions are essentially in 26.1.2, as well as these other provisions, including the exclusion clause in 26.9. With regards to the lead bank, the arranging bank, in this case, it's already left the situation because it's transferred its obligations. It's novated to Singapore. In this case, we would have, if we were looking at Morgan Bank specifically, we would have considered its role provision under 26.3 and the no fiduciary clause under 26.4. 26.3 specifies that the agent bank has no duty of any form under this document, and specifically no fiduciary duty under 26.4. The other three key provisions to mention are the fact that there can be no misstatements in the fact pattern that we have here. It was misrepresented that the vessels were seaworthy and that there was no litigation. The three key clauses we need to watch are no misleading information, that's LMA 1910, those are representations and warranties. No litigation, 1913. And then events of default, if there had been a misrepresentation, 23.4. So those are the three key sets of provisions we need to be aware of. 1910, 1913, and 23.4. And all you have to simply do is build in the actual language in those cases. Because they're limited application clauses, you can look at them, you can read them, you can consider their terms specifically. You will see that they are very generously drafted and will apply in many situations. So for example, 1913. No litigation, arbitration, or administrative proceedings before any court, arbitral body, or agency, which, if adversely determined, might reasonably be expected to have a material adverse effect, to the best of the knowledge and belief of the party, have been started or threatened. So, very widely drafted, although the qualification is, it has to have a material adverse effect. So again, you just look at the nature of those clauses, you explain how they would apply in the relevant factual situation. Now, what we've also got is this. We've got a separate fact pattern which reconsiders many of the same issues, this time from a bond perspective. So what we've got is this. A large US hotel group specializing in corporate and luxury bespoke holiday facilities wishes to construct a new tower in Shanghai. This actually happened. After this fact pattern was drafted, there was two towers. There was the Park Hyatt, then there was the Grand Hyatt. The Grand Hyatt was first, that was the Jiangmen Tower, then the Park Hyatt, and then right beside it they've now built a third tower called the Shanghai Tower. So this situation refers to that. It was actually drafted before the tower was actually constructed. So a hotel group is going to build a new hotel tower. The way this operates is the first set of like 50, 60 floors are commercial office space. Then you have the reception, floors 50, between 50 and 60. And then the hotel is the rest of the building above. So it's going to be called Shanghai 50. They want to borrow $110 million over 20 years, $100 million for construction, and then $10 million for working out. The company approaches Merrill Bank, which advises that the cheapest facility would be available through a multi-option facility, a MOF, with a combination of medium-term notes, shorter commercial paper, a swing-lend currency facility, with, we'll assume, some other ancillary provisions. Merrill Bank recommends trying to obtain $100 million through the medium-term note and $10 million through the commercial paper. After obtaining its mandate, so then it's the documentation, so we need the mandate letter and then the other core provisions. Merrill Bank approaches four other investment banks to act as co-managers, co-dealers under the program agreement. Merrill Lynch prepares draft offering circular, the subscription agreement, trustee agreement, and fiscal agency agreement. In this case, if we have a trustee agreement, we have a paying agency agreement. If there's no trustee, it would be a fiscal agency agreement, because that's to create a separate trust interest on behalf of the investors. The notes and paper are to be issued in an electronic form, so this is fully dematerialised. Then a bank decides to place the allocation of the bonds with one of its investment trusts managed on behalf of wealthy Asian investors, including a global sovereign wealth fund, wealth portfolio. Essentially what will happen is this, this is how the investment bank is going to place the investment. It doesn't need to get back into the wider market, so we're not going to have to consider issues to do with listing and public offers. It's going to use a separate investment arm, wealth management arm, within the same group. There's possibly an issue of conflicts of interest, but we don't need to be concerned with that at this stage. And all the relevant disclosures and consents will have been obtained. Merrill Lynch's standard liability clauses are incorporated into the standard documentation. So we have no duty, no confirmation, no on assessment clause, no inducement, no fiduciary duty. There's also exclusion in relation to innocent negligent and fraudulent misrepresentation, criminal liability and statutory duty. So we can exclude liability for innocent and common law negligence and statutory negligence, but we cannot exclude liability for fraudulent misrepresentation, criminal liability and statutory duty. Those would be disapplied, but the other provisions would still apply. Even if we are held liable, the indemnity clause would still be enforceable. The notes and bonds are duly issued, and the hotel group receives a full amount issued on closing. Trading conditions are more difficult than expected with a global recession. There's a hurricane in Florida. The US government is threatening to sue the parent group, that's still within the borrowing group, over failure to have adopted necessary safety measures. It looks like shortcuts were adopted in construction. The company then subsequently defaults. So we have to consider all of the various issues that may arise. It's basically identical in terms of law and legal analysis to the other fact pattern we've already looked at. So we're going to consider the parties' relationships. We're going to consider the documentation and then the nature of the duties, responsibilities and liabilities of each of the parties, and how we can control those in terms of heads of liability and then limitation of liability. So in this case, outline the main documents that would have to be signed to allow the shipping company to proceed. So we would look at a standard set of bond documents which are also provided on the materials that you have available. So we've got all of the parties listed here and then all of the documentation as well, including the operational provisions and the terms of the bonds. The bonds are essentially fixed interest, longer term instruments. The notes are floating rate, shorter term debt instruments. Commercial paper, exactly the same, up to 1 year. Explain, secondly, the main heads of liability. Again, this is then identical. We have all our heads of common law, innocent, negligent, fraudulent misrepresentation, statutory misrepresentation under the Misrepresentation Act, as well as possible deceit, that's section 19 of the Theft Act 1968, and then possible agency liability, fiduciary liability and regulatory liability. So we explain each of those. It then asks advice on the main defences that may be available. So in this case what we're going to do is look at the controls on liability. So in this case, we've actually incorporated all the relevant provisions. So we have the no duty clauses, we have the limited liability clauses, and we have the indemnity clause. All we have to then watch is the exclusion provisions. They will apply with regards to the common law and the statutory negligence, but they will not apply to the fraudulent misrepresentation, criminal liability, and breach of statutory duty. So we just go through all of these provisions again. The key point is that we're importing the reasonableness test from the Unfair Contract Terms Act 1977 back into the Misrepresentation Act 1967. Sections 2 and 3 we've already mentioned. And then on the 1977 Act, sections 1.1, 2.1, 3.1, 11 and Schedule 2 we've already considered. So the next point then is explain the principal effects of these exclusion clauses. We've just been through all of that. The key point here is then just to try and build in as much of the case law as you can. We looked at Springwell in some detail, but you've also got the decision in PK. You've got the Goldman Sachs case, you've got Deepak, and you've got the Abu Dhabi case. I've given you separate notes on all of these cases. You can build in the judgments, all of that to the extent relevant. Again, we then have to consider the extent to which either the agent bank or the trustee may be liable. We will have equivalent exclusion provisions in the documentation which treat the agent bank in the same manner as would have applied under a bond situation, capital market relation, set of relationships, as well as under a loan situation. So what we can do with all of these provisions is that we can see how the core heads of liability may arise, how each of the parties could be held responsible for breach of either contractual duty or tortious duty to other parties, and then how we can control and limit that liability in practice.